1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 153, Prophetic Communitarianism, a synthesis of hermetic and sociological analyses of the origins of Mormonism, by Bill Martin.
Sunstone Symposium. I'm Melody Lambert, chair for this session, and am to remind all of you that admission is by tag or ticket only, neither of which I have, so I may have to leave. If you don't have either of those, you can register in the East Lobby. Our presenter to my left is Dr. Bill Martin, who received his Ph.D. in philosophy at the University of Kansas in 1991. He's currently an assistant professor at DePaul University in Chicago and the author of The Possibilities of Postmodern Social Theory, Humanism and Its Aftermath, The Shared Fate of Deconstruction and Politics, Politics in the Impasse, Explorations in Post-Secular Social Theory, and his work in progress is Mormon Possibilities, A Theory of Community. His presentation today is Prophetic Communitarianism, a synthesis of hermetic and sociological analyses of the origins of Mormonism. Bill has said that he'll talk for about 35 minutes, and then we'll have about 25 minutes for questions from the audience, and we will end on time. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. In the paper I gave at the Chicago Sunstone last fall, I dealt with Harold Bloom's The American Religion at some length, his Gnostic interpretation, as he calls it, of Mormonism. When contrasted to what I would call instead a normative Mormonism, I find Bloom's interpretation almost entirely wanting, just as I find his so-called Gnostic Judaism wanting in comparison to normative Judaism. However, there might be a broader interpretation, one that might simply be called hermetic, that while it contains some of the significant aspects of Gnosticism, more adequately captures the spirit of Mormonism. Now, such an interpretation, at least for the Mormonism of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, has been presented by historian John L. Brooke in his book, The Refiner's Fire, The Making of Mormon Cosmology, 1644 to 1844. Significantly, in numerous places in the book, and this is the theme of the whole first third of the book, part one, Brooke refers to the Mormons as, quote, a prepared people. And the question might be, prepared for what? A reader of the book, in answer to this question, might have come to the conclusion that Brooke sees the 19th century Mormons as having been prepared for a grand metaphysical hermetic experiment. Now, critics of the book, for example, those who are setting themselves up as the champions of orthodoxy, and I mean, of course, some of the people who write for the review of books on the Book of Mormon, dismiss Brooke's analysis as, quote, environmentalist, and this is a common charge if you read the review of books on the Book of Mormon. Quite often, books written by non-LDS scholars about the Mormons are dismissed as being environmentalist. Their assumption is that Brooke's argument leads to the conclusion that Joseph Smith did no more than to form a synthesis of elements that were present in the social environment of early 19th century New England and Western New York. It seems to me that if Joseph Smith had done no more than to write some interesting books or treatises on theology or magic, then this explanation would be right. But Smith did more than simply create a synthesis of thought. He called forth and led a movement, and he forged a people. Indeed, of the many groups who came together around hermetic ideas and symbols, from the Muggletonians, that wonderfully named group in England that William Blake may indeed have been a part of, from the Muggletonians to the Shakers, only the Mormon movement as such exists today on any kind of scale. That is, not as simply a subterranean mindset or vibe, but as a movement and as a people. I'm leaving aside, by the way, the Christian Scientists, who first are in decline, and second, were never a movement and a people in the way that the Mormons were and are, even if, in fact, Christian Science fits much better Harold Bloom's thesis about Gnosticism. If one were looking for environmental explanations, one would have to give more of an account of how Mormonism went from some ideas about metaphysics that Joseph Smith came up with, to forming its own nation state, to being a continually growing international movement, than to simply show that Mormon cosmology, to use Brooks' phrase, constitutes a neat synthesis. In other words, we would need more than philosophical idealism. Brooke, of course, gives us much more than idealism, for he demonstrates the continual appeal and emergence or reemergence of Hermetic ideas in various cultures throughout human history. In a sense, his work parallels that of Hugh Nibley on this point, when the latter, Nibley, is specifically focusing on what might be called anticipations of the Mormon cosmology, for example, in books such as Temple and Cosmos. Professor Nibley, however, does not only focus on this aspect of Mormonism, he has also written extensively, and I think incisively, brilliantly, and inspiringly, on the ethical and communitarian and even ecological aspects of Mormonism, and he has written from the perspective of one committed to all of these aspects. Indeed, one might refer to Nibley's thought as a whole as representative of a bringing together of cosmos, temple, and Zion. I find it hard to call Brooks' study simply environmentalist because he clearly demonstrates that the ideas that appealed to, and I would say going beyond Brick, but not that far, we could just say were revealed to or called to, the ideas that appealed to Joseph Smith were ideas that managed to break through from time to time in human history, always emerging over and against some established orthodoxy. And it is not a far stretch to say that these marginal ideas continued to assert themselves because they contained some vital truths. But what sort of truths would these be? My argument is that such truths, as Brooke discusses, must both say something about, quote, the way the world is, and about possibilities for human flourishing. In other words, such ideas must make sense, express their truths in people's lives. And it is this latter aspect of Hermetic ideas that Brooke tends to ignore, sometimes on principle. If one wanted, therefore, to fill out the environmental picture, then one would also need to show how, in their social circumstances, people were prepared to receive and take up, that is, to live, the ideas and narratives presented to and by Joseph Smith. Now, in his book, Exiles in a Land of Liberty, Mormons in America, 1830 to 1846, Kenneth Wynn, to my mind, does an excellent job of filling out this side of the picture. And yet, just as one might say that Brooke has demonstrated well how Mormon cosmology forms something of an integrated ontological system, but has not shown why or how this coherence issues in a correspondence to what people need in their lives, one might also argue that Wynn provides a picture of Mormonism as purely reactive to social circumstances. In other words, Wynn's argument might be described as too secular, too mechanically materialist, able to show why communitarian movements formed on the fringes of emerging industrial and financial capitalism in post-revolutionary America, but not why Joseph Smith's particular visions had such a galvanizing force in this milieu. What's needed, then, is a synthesis in which cosmos and Zion come together, but one in which the latter, Zion, is not simply subsumed under the former, for, as someone once put it, the philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. Now, from this point on, I'm actually going to talk about Brooke almost exclusively because his book is newer and more of a subject of discussion at the present time, but I have the Wynn book with me, and I know it well, and I'd be happy to get into it a little bit more in the discussion if people want to. So to frame the issue once more, then, Brooke and Wynn each give valuable but one-sided portraits of the emergence of Mormonism. I'm calling Brooke's the Hermetic side and Wynn's the sociological side. A synthesis of the two sides would not only give a more comprehensive picture of what was revealed to and by Joseph Smith and what proceeded from that revelation, a movement, a people, long-standing institutional structures, but it would also show why the term environmentalist is inadequate for explaining the totality of what emerged with the restored gospel, namely something implicit, something elements of which had been seen before, something that had been tried before in various ways, something restored, but also something needed and new, something underdetermined by all of the elements that make it up, something revealed. Now, from the very beginning of the refiner's fire, Brooke speaks to this underdetermination in an argument against what he calls the functionalist approach. He says, starting in the 1960s, a central theme in the interpretation of Mormon origins has been that the new religion was a functional response to the social stress experienced by poor families in the northeastern countryside and frontier in the wake of the American Revolution. Against this approach, Brooke argues that, and I'm quoting, though the functionalist theory of social stress may well explain the potential for the emergence of a radical restorationist movement and the potential for a response to such a message, it cannot explain the theologically distinct message of the Mormon Church or sufficiently explain the social origins of the converted membership. Significantly, one of the historians Brooke takes issue with as a proponent of this so-called social stress view is Kenneth Wynn, and also a host of others, including Richard Bushman and Marvin Hill, who, unlike Wynn, who's a non-LDS scholar, these others, Bushman and Hill, are observant members of the LDS Church. Instead of this so-called functionalist approach, and I would put that term actually in scare quotes, functionalist, because I dispute the idea that the socialist stress explanations are in all cases functionalists or necessarily so, Brooke proposes a thesis of intellectual and cultural continuity. Brooke notes that such a thesis had actually been influential before functionalism had become so predominant, but, and I'm quoting again, although my book, Brooke's book, is in some measure a statement of the Whitney Cross and David Brian Davis thesis of cultural continuity, I must dissent from their rooting of Mormonism in the Puritan culture of old New England. Rather than running from the Puritanism brought to New England in the Great Migration, firmly situated in the magisterial reformation of Calvinist theology and state-supported religion, Mormonism springs from the sectarian tradition of the Radical Reformation, in fact, from its most extreme fringe, end quote. Now, it seems to me that Brooke demonstrates this cultural continuity well enough, but also in a one-sided way. That is, while he acknowledges that, in almost every case, the groups on the extreme fringe of the Radical Reformation were engaged in utopian and communitarian politics, this social experimentation seems merely incidental to the story Brooke wants to tell. Now, to be fair, Brooke says that this is not necessarily, I'm quoting him, is not necessarily a well-rounded approach to early Mormonism, end quote, and that the part of the book dealing with Mormonism per se, as opposed to the Hermetic background more generally, is, I'm quoting, less a balanced history of Mormonism than a reconstruction of the intellectual life of Joseph Smith Jr. and the Mormon leadership in light of the Hermetic tradition. Now, in this latter effort, back to me now, Brooke succeeds admirably, I think, but perhaps too much so. Brooke provides a wealth of detail regarding both the Hermetic tradition in general and the local and family backgrounds of Joseph Smith. In the latter case, he sometimes loses sight, in my view, of the fact that he can, at most, only speak of the possible implications of Smith's background for what emerged in Smith's visions and revelations, not to absolute connections. Brooke traces in great detail the cultural backgrounds of various members of the Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack Smith families, regarding everything from peepstones to counterfeiting. Undoubtedly, these backgrounds exerted a great deal of influence upon the young Joseph Smith Jr., but I think Brooke somewhat overstates the case for connections. As the reviewers in the review books on the Book of Mormon put it, we learned that a certain Thomas, I'm quoting now, we learned that a certain Thomas Ingersoll had, quote, connections to the Smith circle of money diggers. But what was the nature of those connections? Thomas, quote, was either a brother or a third cousin of Peter Ingersoll, whom the Smiths had allegedly tried to recruit into their money-digging club. And what significance is there really in the datum noted above that the counterfeiter Joseph Bill was a, quote, second cousin once removed of Samuel Bill, who would marry Joseph Smith's Aunt Lydia Mack in 1786? How many readers of this review, we wonder, can name a second cousin once removed of their maternal aunt's husband? How many have been significantly influenced by him or her? I know myself that I could not only not tell you who, if anyone, such a relation might be in my family, in my family tree, I also know that I would not want her or his views or activities attributed to me, and I'm sure that goes the other way around as well. I come from a family of very southern Peckerwood redneck relations, so assuming that I even have a a second cousin once removed of my maternal aunt's husband. God only knows what they're up to, and they probably wouldn't approve of me very much either. For the record, I think the reviewers from the review books of the Book of Mormon overstate their case quite a bit, too. They do point out some rather large gaps and inaccuracies in Brooks' argument, and that Joseph Smith himself would probably not have thought of the experiment that he was involved in terms of Hermetic lore. But Brooke does establish that such lore permeated the milieu from which Smith came. But the larger point is that Brooke sometimes does not see the forest for the trees, and he is in danger of allowing his own cultural continuity model, as he puts it, to become an overdetermined framework. Brooke sets up this investigation as follows. He says, I'm quoting, "We are faced with a series of problems. We need to define as precisely as possible how and why occult practices of divining and the systematic theology of Hermetic perfectionism last seen in 17th century Europe reemerged in the 19th century American world of Joseph Smith. We also need to examine the relationships and affinities that connected magical practice and Hermetic perfection with the dispensational restorationism that was such a central part of Joseph Smith's cosmology. And most specifically," I'm still quoting, "we need to know more definitively who were the prepared people in the American settlements, who could accommodate both magical practice and religious devotion, who were prepared for the supernaturalist fusion of Hermetic authority and millenarian restorationism that Joseph Smith would begin to preach in 1830. In short, we need to map the social and cultural geography of the intersection of religion and the Hermetic occult in early America." Okay, and that's the end of the quote. Into the quotation. Actually, I hate it when people say quote. There are two questions we might ask about this framework that Brooke is setting out. First, assuming that understanding Joseph Smith and the emergence of Mormonism is a matter of understanding the intersection that gave rise to them, is Brooke giving us the best map of this intersection? Second, can we understand that Mormonism is simply a complex intersection of complex ideas, or is there something more to what emerged? It's unclear what might be meant by religion, as Brooke uses it in the formulation I just read. Without going into that question, however, in other words, religion versus something called magic, and I'm unclear on why, on what the distinction is exactly. It seems very clear to me that Joseph Smith, at least once he began having visions and began to call a people forth, probably would not have thought of what was happening to him or what he was doing in terms of Hermeticism, even though that might be a useful description from from an external standpoint. But why that's set over and against something else called religion, I'm just not clear on why that's the case. But without going into that question too much further right now, it seems to me that the answer to the first question is no, that Brooke does not have enough elements in his map. He doesn't bring all of the elements to bear on the kind of intersection he's looking for that he should, and the way that he frames some of the elements that he does have, which mainly have to do with ideas concerning ontology or metaphysics, is suspect. The worldview represented in the Book of Mormon and other writings that came to or from Joseph Smith might be called a complex synthesis of biblical Judaism and Christianity with what we might call Hermetic ideas, if by the latter we mean no more than a complex sense of the interconnectedness of things. Hermeticism then might occupy the space between the coldest mechanical materialism, all is atoms and the void, and a truly supernaturalist conception of God as holy other, which it turns out is also a rather cold sensibility. The warmer sensibility of Joseph Smith can be connected, to be sure, to ideas that have asserted themselves many times in human history. And the reviewers from the review of books on the Book of Mormon quip, I'm quoting, "Why not take Hermeticism and alchemy back to their origins in Hellenistic Egypt? Brooke's subtitle could then read, The Making of Mormon Cosmology, 344 BC to AD 1844. And I think they're right to make that point. In this case, we could also refer to a huge list of philosophers as, quote, hermetic, from Pythagoras to Spinoza to Hegel, possibly even Karl Marx in some moments to Alfred North Whitehead, Charles Hartshorne, etc. Yes? Well, why don't we get into that in the discussion, but really what I meant, it seems to me that all that brings that term together for Brooke is a sense of the interconnectedness of things. And but let's get into that in the discussion, if you don't mind, just so I can... And seeing those supposedly subterranean interconnections and not allowing that there's any kind of solid wall between the things seen and the things unseen, but there is the possibility of crossing over, which is what Brooke talks about. But let's get into that a little more in the discussion. Significantly, however, for Joseph Smith, the source of his theology, even at its most hermetic, is the Bible. But the further point is that the omission of the ethical political framework from the intersection that Brooke is searching for is a crucial gap in his argument. Joseph Smith was all about the idea that there is a plan of redemption in the cosmos, a plan set out by Heavenly Father and participated in by Heavenly Mother and other gods. In the Mormon view, this plan of redemption is set out from within the cosmos and on their plane, and in worlds without end, the gods engage in an unending work of redemption. In Joseph Smith's version of Christianity, however, humanity is not just a passive spectator of this unfolding struggle. This is an important point because Brooke makes it seem as though Joseph Smith was mainly the bringer of a philosophy or theology, and that a movement formed out of people who were enthusiasts of this philosophy. But the point is, once again, not just to interpret the world. All creatures who have agency are called to take part in this work of redemption. Now, actually, as a philosophical argument that maybe we can get into in the discussion, I think it could be shown that it is in the very nature of responsible agency to take part in this work, just as it is in the very nature of agency to be called by responsibility. And personally, I've attempted to show this in my own work using the philosophy of Jacques Derrida and the analytical philosopher Donald Davidson. Finding ourselves where we are, this means struggling to create a Zion society, a redeemed earth. In a sense, then, Brooke takes up so-called millennial restorationism as pure idea, but not as work, as struggle. And it seems to me if you take up so-called millennial restorationism in this way, that's to fundamentally falsify what millennial restorationism is. In the first part of The Refiner's Fire, Brooke shows how, out of a, as he puts it, series of fault lines racking the spiritual life of Reformation Europe, came a series of spiritual experiments involving esoterica of hermetic divination. It would be wrong to simply see the latter, this esoterica, as well as other interesting restorationist or primitivist or otherwise, shall we say, post-Catholic conceptions as simply epiphenomenal. In other words, simply ideas that don't have any weight in their own right, but simply as reactions based on social stress. But it's just as wrong, it seems to me, to not see the social basis and ethical political implications of these ideas. The series of fault lines might be described as follows. The circuit of thought and practice initiated with the fundamental sidetracking of the early Christian movement into the great apostasy was coming to a close. It had played itself out. The world of Roman Catholicism was turning into the brave new world of capitalism and colonialism. The green language, as Raymond Williams puts it, of the countryside was giving way to the dingy gray noise of the city. into the breach stepped a series of thinkers and actors who wanted neither a return to the Ancien regime nor a so-called advance to the dark satanic mills. The ideas offered by such thinkers, William Blake, who I just invoked, would be a perfect example, were comprehensive and meant to be practical. Brooke argues that, and I'm quoting, we can isolate four distinctly different spiritual authorities competing for popular allegiance in this struggle. And here are his four: church reformers, utopian prophets, cunning folk, and Christian hermetic magi. The thrust of Brooke's entire argument as intellectual biography is to show how Joseph Smith transformed himself from a so-called village conjurer into a Christian hermetic magus, and indeed into an antinomian substitute for Christ himself. So now I'm quoting, salvation and then divination would come not from grace alone, but from the merit of obedience to sacred ordinance. The result was a new sin-free dispensation. Mormons were inherently perfectible and beyond the bounds of human law. In essence, they were offered the promise of an antinomian perfectionism if only they obeyed the authority of the prophet leader. This is the conclusion that Brooke reaches after a very long and detailed pursuit of his methodology. Given that there is almost nothing of the Zion ideal, or the ideal of acting out ourselves the plan of redemption, and that the plan depends on what we do, given that there's nothing of the Zion ideal or of the various experiments initiated as pathways to this ideal shown in Brooke's methodology, I'm inclined to say that so-called intellectual biography is just not the way to understand Joseph Smith. I suppose, too, the question is one of what Jesus was all about. Was he first of all concerned to spread the message of a new and improved metaphysics? And what the early Christian movement was all about. I love this joke about Jesus saying to Peter, "Who do you say that who do you say that I am?" And Peter responding, "You're the object of our ultimate concern and the ground of our being." And Jesus saying, "Huh?" For sure, Jesus said and did some things that have interesting, perhaps profound and momentous metaphysical implications, and we ought to think about these implications, but with an eye toward doing something about them. But a one-sided emphasis on these implications fundamentally falsifies what Jesus was about, which was a work of reconciliation or atonement and redemption. A testimony to that work is not some magic incantation, or, okay, there might be some magic to it, but it isn't just that, but a commitment made publicly to join in that work. A parallel example, by the way, might be a purely academic Marxism, which simply sees Marx's tools of analysis as an interesting intellectual construct, but another way to interpret the world, but without fundamentally acting to change the world. All of this discussion could be summed up easily enough, and I'm concluding now. Of the categories Brooks sets out, I would argue that Joseph Smith was a utopian prophet and activist, so I just think he's got it wrong, and not a Christian hermetic magi. Coming finally to the second question I asked some time ago, is there something more to the Restoration than simply a complex intersection of complex ideas? The answer certainly, to my mind, turns out to be yes, if we consider that the inclusion of the Zion ideal in the mix means that a fundamental gap between cosmos and Zion has to be bridged by means that cannot simply be synthetic or dialectical, but instead this gap has to be bridged through a work and struggle wherein, to use Gadamer's terminology, truth consistently outruns methodology. To use the way Marx thinks about it, practice outruns theory. It just seems to me that if you don't take into account the redemptive practice of the Mormon movement, you can certainly show, as Brooke does that there's an interesting mix of ideas that were there in New England, post-revolution New England and Western New York, and that Joseph Smith had some connection to those ideas, and that in some sense those ideas pop up in his own thought. But I don't think you can explain the Zion ideal. And without that, I think you've fundamentally missed the point. So I found it a very interesting book. It fills out, it gives us an interesting picture in some ways, but it doesn't really explain what I think of as the essence of Joseph Smith or of the Mormon movement. So I'll stop now, and I'd be happy to hear what you have to say. Thank you for listening.
How does this make connection with the conventional orthodoxy of grace, the theories of grace, wherein we wait here for Jesus to come back and then he takes care of everything, but we just, there's a, like you indicated or implied, there's a veil between that, a hermetic veil, which we can't bridge, whereas Joseph Smith comes along and says, no, you do this, and you're in partnership with God or the faiths to bring this about.
Well, I mean, I think in the second part of what you said, you answered the question. I mean, the Zion ideal, as I understand it, is an activist ideal. It's not simply a waiting. What's the place of grace in all of this? I suppose it's that. There are elements in the cosmos that we need and that we don't make ourselves. Therefore, some of the things we need to redeem the earth are simply a gift, as our lives are, as the earth is, as the cosmos itself is. We didn't act to bring it about, nor do we deserve it in any meaningful sense. And so that gift is absolutely necessary. But, you know, again, to quote Marx, you probably didn't expect to hear Marx being quoted so much, but I think Marx said something very profound when he said that people have to emancipate themselves. No one else can do it for them. I mean, there's certainly a sense here in the Zion ideal that simply waiting for it runs quite contrary to the sense of what that ideal is, because no one, even God, from the outside, can simply say, okay, you're emancipated now, if there's not that activity on my part and it may be the lesser part. It may be the lesser part, but without that activity of responsibility, which is fundamental to what we are, there's no redemption. So, and to see how those things work together as a complex whole, I mean, that's the trick, of course.
But it causes more anxiety to move forth to the microphone and suppresses questioning, in my experience. So, I'll make this brief. You suggest that in Brooke we find an idea that there was a philosophy in New England, and that. Called Hermetism or Hermeticism, and that followers of Joseph Smith came to Joseph Smith because they found in Joseph Smith this philosophy, or alternatively that this philosophy influenced Joseph Smith and that he assumed in a naturalistic fashion elements of this philosophy. But I suggest to you that in Brooks there's another methodology, sort of maybe not at the surface of Brooke, but it appears in later comments in his book, is that Hermeticism was not just a philosophy, a worldview, but at the heart of Hermeticism, there was an inclination towards an experience. That Hermeticism was not a dry philosophy. Hermeticism was a type of religious experience, that it was a philosophy which came out of a vast 2,000-year history, as the Farms reviewer said of Brooks' book, that came out of a very ancient philosophy. And at the center of this philosophy was a desire for personal revelation, a desire for the prophetic consciousness. And so you mentioned a little bit later that, you know, Jesus really offered us a work of reconciliation and an atonement. Well, at the heart of the Hermetic philosophy, there was a desire for reconciliation, a resolution of the oppositeness we exist in, the opposition of spirit and matter, of light and dark, that Hermeticism sought the reformation of man through that reconciliation and at-one-ment, and salvation. And that salvation was the Philosopher's Stone. It was, in a sense, a new Zion. So although those themes are not prominent in Brooke's work, and I would agree that Brooke is more of an intellectual history, those themes do exist in Hermetism, in Hermeticism, and indeed may be a theme which had influence upon Joseph Smith, not to give him his ideas, but to grant him a road to his experience. And that may be more a comment than a question, but I'll let you respond.
Well, hang on, I'm going to ask you. I mean, my question would be, in what sense is the Philosopher's Stone, what was the expression you used, a Zion or a making of Zion? Because it seems to me that, well, it could be or it wouldn't necessarily be. And this is the side of Bloom's book that I really object to, right? The Gnostic side, that really what it's all about in the final analysis is to be alone with God and to understand that I am God, and once I get to that point, of course I can be alone with God, and I want to be alone for some reason, I guess because I don't like anyone else or I find them a distraction or something. And in a certain sense, what you were saying as the Hermetic ideal, I guess I thought that brought out that more Gnostic sense of redemption, which to my mind has very little in common with the Mormon movement as I understand it.
First, I would distance myself from Bloom's definition of Gnosticism, and Bloom's ideas related to Gnosticism are indeed a type of Gnosticism. But Gnosticism in modern parlance, in late 20th century parlance, is a vast, diffuse, nebulous thing, and just about anything can be called Gnostic and has been by somebody at some time. So I would distance myself a bit from that. But speaking directly to the Hermetic issue, within Hermetism, there was a desire for a work. There was a desire for the transformation of man. And this came out of a late alchemical tradition. It was related to Hermetism in its full blossom in the 16th century. And in that, there was a desire not just to create out of gold or out of lead gold, but as Jung Carl Gustav Jung, the psychologist, has emphasized, as other students of Hermetism and alchemy have emphasized, there it is, for the transformation of base matter into something higher, something divine, not gold in the vulgar sense. The alchemist said, Aurum nostrum non est ora vulgi, which means our gold is not the vulgar gold, that yellow stuff that you get money for. Our gold is the lucre of a is not that filthy lucre, but it is the transformed human being. It is the man who is the resolution of the opposites of spirit and matter, of dark and light. And they looked for the coming of the prophet Elias to bring this restoration. In fact, they felt that the prophet Elias had to come into the work to change it, and that the stone was really the philosopher himself. When he became transformed, he was a higher man, a new man, in a sense an endowed man, a man who was coming into the flesh of Godhood. And they looked for that Zion society. If you look in the Reformation cultures of the 17th century, or 16th century particularly, I'd say 17th century, more properly, 1600s, you see that after the 30 Years' War and throughout that conflict, there are a lot of people looking for Zion. And these people had Hermetic philosophy tied in deeply with their fundamentalist Protestant and sometimes even Catholic ideologies. But I'll step back. That's too much comment. Thank you.
Thank you. What, why don't I ask others to come up and...
I think we can all agree that within the teachings of Joseph Smith, there are definitely Hermetic concepts, alchemic concepts, and such. And yet, in reading Brooke's work, and I guess I'm asking you, how does one reconcile the fact that These concepts, which have been absorbed into Mormonism as a very materialistic religion, a very non-dualistic religion, and yet the origins and the history of all of these traditions, these occult traditions, are extremely dualistic. And they seem to be fundamentally at odds with one another, and yet some very interesting and very seminal concepts have come over to Joseph's side, but I don't. Joseph was never a dualist. How do you reconcile? How would Brooke reconcile such a contradiction?
I think it goes back to the earlier comment about seeing instead of an absolute veil, a kind of continuity among different levels of the organization of matter. So unlike what I understand of some forms of Gnosticism, Joseph Smith doesn't hold that there's something called absolute spirit that's absolutely different from even the crassest forms of matter, which does run counter, at least, to some forms of Gnosticism, as I understand them, going back, for example, to Plotinus, that holds that matter is base and unredeemable. One of about four Greek words that I know, it's kakia, it's kaka, it's shit, it's unredeemable. Plato thought that there were a few things that were too base even to have forms, lint, manure, that's not a part, that's not in the worldview of Joseph Smith. But I would always want to bring out the social dimension of this. I mean, for example, as a more or less agrarian movement, well, nobody who has an agrarian orientation thinks that manure is so base as to not have any importance in our lives. It makes the world go round, if you want to put it that way. If Joseph Smith gets to some of these hermetic ideas, I think it's more through a kind of continuity than through the sort of absolute leap that you find in most... I'm not an expert on this, but I mean, far from it, but it seems to me in most understandings of Gnosticism, I mean, well, you have to have the gnosis, you have to have the leap to this wholly other world. So I want to be fair, so make sure I call on people who've had their hands up.
Well, I kind of relate to the idea of sanctification in the church as something to be made holy, and I believe that is an important part of this equation. I forget if you wanted to...
Expand on that a little bit, sanctification.
Well, they talk a lot about the goal is of a Mormon is to become sanctified. Anyone that hasn't. And the word sanctification means to be made holy. And that's a real loose term, but I see that as maybe what we're talking about here.
Well, it just seems to me that a fundamental part of Mormonism is a very communitarian sense of what that means, so that it, the pursuit of sanctification can't be the activity of a solitary individual or ego. It has to do with the work that we do in common to create a redeemed earth that is suitable for the Messiah to return to. So it's not a waiting, it's a working together. So, that's sort of an ideal reading, or maybe what I would think of as the better reading, but it seems to me that that's quite, it's nothing alien to anybody who's really thought about what Mormonism is about. The comment was that in the DNC, those who've achieved exaltation will receive the white stone, which may be the philosopher's stone. I don't know. I don't know, but I would. It sounds like the same sort of thing. But it seems to me that what that's really all about is that those who go far will be able to will be granted the gift of seeing even further. And seeing further in what? This is what I have problems with in Brooke. To read him
And I'm not saying it's not a very good book. I think it's a very illuminating book. But to read him, it seems to me he's saying to see further into the mysteries of metaphysics or something, to have a better metaphysical theory, whereas it seems to me that what Mormonism is more about is to see further in the work of redemption, which requires not only sort of drudge work and struggle in a fairly, directly practical sense, but also visions and revelations to see further. So
I haven't read books, so I'm wondering if he or anyone you know of does this kind of cultural continuity, connecting this to more Anglo-Saxon traditions that come out of Celtic mysticism and Druid practices or Druid beliefs. So it seems like that's where New England got most of its people originally.
He doesn't connect. That's a very interesting question. He doesn't connect it to Celtic traditions, but more to the Radical Reformation in England and Northern Europe. But that would be an interesting.
I fully appreciate your comments on Brooke and having failed to go to that social dimension of Mormonism. However, do you see any contradiction between what Brooke does and what then you say should be done after Brooke, perhaps, or maybe where he should have gone? Isn't it possible to read Brooke as someone who has opened up this vast area of Joseph Smith's life of the mind, which was which we didn't know as well, and that then we go on, and would Brooks perhaps contradict you? Would he say, yes, okay, if I wrote another book, maybe I would do what you want me to do?
Actually, I do see a contradiction, and it might simply be a contradiction in tone or style, but being a student of Jacques Derrida, I sort of see style is pretty important, actually. And what I mean is this. It seems to me that the works such as Brooke's, such as D. Michael Quinn's book, which Brooke, by the way, as anyone knows who's read the book, more or less accepts and to some extent builds on. The problem I find with such works is not that they uncover some interesting aspects of early Mormonism. I think that's fine. But again, their tone or style, which is almost the tone of an expose. And it doesn't, and in fact, a lot of the trouble that's come down, I think, on such figures mainly has to do with that tone, because the question is, well, whose side are you on, basically? But I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, the difference, you might say, between Brooke and Quinn on the one side and Hugh Nibley on the other, I mean, Hugh Nibley uncovers all of this stuff. He doesn't have any problem talking about this sort of stuff. So what's the difference? I mean, I don't want to speak to a person's commitment. I mean, who am I to judge that? Or who is anyone to judge that? But the difference with Nibley is that when he talks about, well, gee, there are these prefigurations of Mormonism going all the way back to 344 BC or whatever, is that he thinks there's prefigurations because there's truth there. You know, why do these things keep resurfacing? Well, maybe because they're true. And that at a certain point with Joseph Smith, they come together. They more come together. Well, Brooke shows nicely how they come together as a neat synthesis, as I keep putting it. But he doesn't. But it tends to be in a bit of a carping way. I mean, what's interesting is in the last couple of chapters of the book. I think the second to last chapter is the "Let Mysteries Alone" chapter, or it might actually be the last chapter. He sort of runs down the Latter-day Saints and the leadership, including Brigham Young, for the supposed de-emphasis of this hermetic side in the name of live your religion. But it strikes me that if living your religion wasn't always part of it, then again, it's simply an interesting philosophical or intellectual pursuit. And so I quoted, as you know, in the very beginning of my paper, once again, Karl Marx, of the philosophers having only interpreted the world, the point being to change it. It seems to me there is that difference, that intentation of this study. And it's not that it's not an interesting study, but more, and it's not that it's not an interesting study that others could take up and try to use it to fill out the Zion ideal, but it's certainly not oriented that way, and it to my mind, ignores that ideal to the point that it's a deep problem. It's not just a surface, you could do that too sort of thing. No, go ahead. Well, we got a couple minutes.
This is a question that came up in Kingston at the MHA, the Mormon History Association, where Brooke
unfortunately,
was.
I couldn't afford to
Brooke was there, and there was a panel discussion, and we heard Brooke, and to some extent this was thrown out, at him, and his argument was, well, I'm a secular historian, I'm not a Mormon, and why should I be expected to write this as in the way in which Hugh Nibley writes it? Hugh Nibley writes it as a believing Mormon. He isn't really a historian. He looks at it. He knows the truth. And for him, this is all a kind of hindsight, if you wish. I mean, he just fits together what he knows. Whereas Brooke comes at it from the other direction as a secular historian to whom Mormonism is no different than Islam or Hinduism or Druids or whatever, you see, and who is simply interested in finding out how something as interesting, as fascinating as Mormonism came into being and how someone like Joseph Smith would latch on to what he sees as some fascinating ideas.
I mean, some of you who know me know that I myself am not LDS, but on the other hand, I'm neither a historian nor secular. But it seems to me, though, that there are a couple different approaches to the Latter-day Saints from a non-LDS perspective, and one is to have the sort of so-called objective kind of laboratory view. Another is to have a view that's sympathetic to communitarian movements, which is the perspective that I come from. And I suppose... Well, then the question is, you know, can you kick up some interesting stuff from the secular historian's perspective? Well, obviously you can. But to what end? I think it's an important question. I think it's a decisive question. But, who hasn't been called on who'd like to speak? Yeah. Well, let's make sure we get everyone who...
I'd be interested in your comments, Bill, on whether it's a flaw in Occidental religious thought and philosophical thought, or whether it's a benefit to always be casting our thoughts about religion in forms of social action, Zionist movements, social movements, and so on, as opposed to the Oriental tradition where... Each soul is on their own journey. A single person finds their own way through the universe, through the cosmos, and how that works in with this tradition that Brooks is talking about, which might be a launching pad to broach the differences with some of the Oriental religions.
I mean, that's a really heavy question, and I probably don't have the resources to fully respond to it, but... and it might be a not very fair comment, but if that's a fundamental part of the non-Occidental... I actually don't know if the word religion is even adequate. I basically think if you're going to use the word religion of the Western religions, then it's not adequate to the Eastern or vice versa. That what's going on seems so different to me. I don't know that, but if it's the solitary individual's journey to spiritual fulfillment, I reject that. I just
I don't see anything good about that at all, and I don't see anything that has to do with prophetic Judaism or Christianity or Mormonism in that. And I also don't necessarily think that that's all there is to Eastern faiths, but the solitary journey, I'm not very sympathetic to it. I don't think it has much to do with Mormonism. I mean, the church I was raised in, the Presbyterians, that was a church where you went to church and everything was very quiet and solitary. The Mormon services I've attended were not quiet at all. They were very they were pretty raucous by mainstream Protestant standards. There didn't seem to be anything solitary about the Mormon community, and to my mind, that's a lot of what's very appealing about it, and which runs completely counter to most outside perceptions of it, for that matter, as being this sort of very dogmatic, doctrinaire sort of setting. It's quite the opposite of that, and that's not to say. I take a kind of Hegelian position on the various cultures of the world that they wouldn't exist in any long-standing way if they didn't have some truths to teach us, if they didn't allow people to live and possibly to flourish. And so I'm always in favor of learning from all cultures, and I'm not interested in asking for the green card of any culture before I would want to try to learn from it. But it does seem to me that there's just something fundamentally different from the Jewish and Christian and even Islamic traditions from this idea of the solitary journey to spiritual fulfillment. We have maybe half a minute or something if someone wants to. Go ahead.
This might sound like a great hiatus, but the physicists have this problem too. They can't make a connection or liaison between the particle and the wave. They can explain each separately, but they don't know how they get together. But that's life. You've got the isolated individual, the particle, and you've got the entire religious community, the wave. And this hermeticism is the same problem the physicists have of kind of see through this veil, this mystery. And they never do. And maybe that's what the church leaders mean when they say, don't look after a mystery that is an infinite mystery. You approach it, but you never find it.
Just as a...
You can't experience the mystery, and that's what
Hermeticism is. Yes, but then you've got to communicate. You see? That's the mystery problem. You can't communicate and isolate...
Only through symbols. Only through symbols can you really communicate that.
Well, I was going to say the particle probably doesn't think about being isolated and wonder why, whereas we do. And we do through symbols, through experience that's the product of shared meanings. And so I actually don't think it's the same. I don't think it's the same issue as the particle and the wave. But even in physics, I mean, there wouldn't be any particles without waves. And so maybe that's the resolution. Well, listen, thank you very much for your questions and comments.